The following podcast is sponsored by SuperheroStuff.com.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of H2O. Jason Hunt here along with my comrade-at-arms, Mr. Timothy Harvey.
Hello.
How is your recovery going?
Recovery's going all right. I had dental surgery, folks, for those of you who are wondering what the heck we're talking about. And there are all sorts of interesting, fun things they tell you you can't have once they do fun things like cut into your jaw.
Yeah.
Hot coffee. That's kind of been the hardest one. Actually, I should be able to have hot drinks again here soon. But I actually I'm holding in my hand a carbonated beverage, which I have not been able to have for a week.
Well, that's good. It's progress.
It is progress. But I can't have crunchy food, which means chips, peanuts, chips. You know, I'm a big fan of tortilla chips.
It's the little things.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Chips and cheese. Tortilla chips and cheese. Sure. That. Yeah. Nope. Yeah. Not for another 2.5 weeks. Mm. So, you know. But other than that, doing fine. I now know what Vicodin is for. And I can't say I'm a fan. I have cheerfully managed to avoid painkillers, aside from ibuprofen. It's been the highest level of painkiller I've had in almost 45 years, until last week.
Wow. but really, though, I mean, how many times have you actually needed it? It says a lot that you haven't really taken that many.
Right, I have not taken very many. It wasn't ridiculously painful. I mean, I actually have a fairly high pain threshold as it is, but... it wasn't that, but there was a couple times it becomes the kind of dull ache that just won't go away.
Sure.
That kind of wears you down.
I've got that going on right now with my hand.
Yes, because you set yourself on fire.
Yes, I did. We're
broken.
And the older we get, the worse it gets, right? No, the youngling requested fried okra. Mm-hmm. So I've got the skillet out. I've got the oil heating up in the pan, and I've breaded the okra and started to put it in the oil. And I guess usually I'll put them in, you know, 1 or 2, 3 pieces at a time, and it never does anything. It'll pop and sizzle a little bit, mm-hmm. but not anything major. I think I might have put in 1 or 2 mini, one or two too many pieces at a time.
Right.
Maybe one of them dropped in, you know, without me seeing it, and suddenly this oil is reaching up and grabbing my hand. So the entire side of my hand now has a second-degree burn. There's a blister on it. Is half as thick as my finger, and it looks pretty bad.
Generally speaking.
Yeah. So I was dealing with that for most of the evening because that was at the beginning of the fried okra.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't even started yet.
Yeah.
And now I've got all of this okra that I've got to fry, and my hand is just on fire. It's just one of those weeks, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so last week we're talking about, what were we talking about last week? We talked about
trailers.
Trailers, yes. Yeah. We talked about the trailers of all of these different movies. And one of them being Mad Max Fury Road, the legacy trailer.
Right.
And that got us talking about all of the 80s stuff. And so we're going to take this week and talk a little bit about games from the 80s, because it does kind of tie in. This is something that I think at some point we probably want to talk about. The collapse of the video game industry in that time, because that's about the same. That's about the time where everything fell apart.
Oh yeah.
James and I sat and watched Atari Game Over a few weeks ago,
right.
The documentary that Zach Penn did,
mm-hmm.
and it's really, really interesting. Have you seen that yet?
I have not.
I recommend it. If any of you have any interest at all in that time period, or video games in general. Or any historical stuff. It is really, really interesting to see what happened there. And the urban legend, when I was a kid, I never knew anything about this. I don't know how I missed it. But the urban legend was that E.T.,
right,
the video game,
mm-hmm.
killed Atari.
Yeah.
And subsequently killed the video game industry at that time. Huge setback. ruined the career of the guy who designed it. Mm-hmm. All of this stuff, terrible, terrible, what all stuff happened, and every E.T. video game cartridge was buried in the New Mexico desert.
Mm-hmm.
And that turns out to be kind of, sort of,
it is
half true.
It has some elements of truth to it. I remember hearing about this when they dug it up.
Yeah, but to see the work that that this one guy did to excavate, to research even, where to start looking in this landfill in New Mexico, and for them to actually turn things up. But it was funny to watch because the entire thing, it uses the search for the ET, you know, it uses that excavation as an entry point, but it doesn't stay exactly with that. It talks about the whole rise and fall of Atari as this giant juggernaut. I mean, that thing just exploded out of nowhere and became this huge thing. Everybody had an Atari 2600. I had one. Did you have one?
You know what? I did not. We were not a video game at home family. The earliest I actually was playing video games on something resembling a computer or computer-ish or was going over to my friend Calvin's place to play Lode Runner on his Apple II.
Oh.
So, but
Lode Runner. Wow.
Yeah, you know, I don't have it on my Mac, but on my old PC desktop, I actually had a virtual, one of the virtual versions of Lode Runner. And it's not this. Well, we used to build our own. We used to design because on the and you'd, it was a double sided disk,
right?
Double sided floppy, 6-inch.
For those of you,
was it 6 inches? Good Lord, those were huge.
Five and a half inch. Yeah.
yeah, for those of you who don't remember, which could be a significant chunk of you.
Well, even then, you know, there's a lot of people that don't even remember the 3-inch, the hard disk that came after that.
But these were the, imagine something about the size of a DVD. However,
yep.
Outside that same size circle was a rectangle or a square. So you basically have this big black flat floppy disk. It was basically it wiggled, and this was your basic element of this was your basic software kind of thing for your computers. And God, how much space were on those?
Oh,
they did not. They,
not a it's, lot I mean, at all. I mean,
basically, you know, you've heard that you can run, you know, your phone has more processing power than the entire Apollo program.
Yeah.
Basically, I think your electric alarm clock, sitting, you know, the one that doesn't have any power, doesn't have any processing power, usually has more storage space than a floppy disk. Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of space.
I think they were only what. 52 gigs?
Maybe something
50,
like
that. No, 52 megs. We weren't talking in gigs. We were in megabytes back then. Gigs were
a dream. But it was a double-sided floppy, so basically you would, on the one side would be the game, then you would flip it over, and you could build levels for the game. And yep. So my friend Calvin and I were quite cheerfully capable of coming up with really, really evil levels for the other one to play. That were the rule was you had to be able to beat them, but it didn't have to make it easy.
Yeah, these were 720 kilobyte double density 3.5-inch micro floppy disks that were the IBM had, but most of these didn't have very much storage space at all. No. I think 720 was probably at the top end back
yeah,
then.
Yeah, I mean, so it's just...
That's not even a meg, folks. I mean, come on.
I got photos on my computer that take up more space. I think, wow, yeah. I mean, that's like, I think some of the photos for the Constantine article I just wrote are I think I probably downloaded that much space just in photos from the
NBC's
website.
Well, but the interesting thing about this film, about the thing, it talks about Atari. They made $375 million in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
In 1981, in today's dollars, that would be billions.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this whole thing, this company, they were populated by these really eccentric rock star engineers and game designers and people that you wouldn't normally expect to be, you know. And this is back before the dot-coms. This is back before Apple, before Microsoft was a big thing. All of this stuff was just starting out.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody knew. Nobody had heard of Steve Jobs. We didn't have anything. And
right.
the Silicon Valley, as we know it now, that wasn't there either.
Right.
This was the beginning. And Atari rose to its prominence in this time. In 1981, $375 million. It was the fastest growing company in American history at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Warner Communications, ended up saying, hey, we'd like a piece of that. So they ended up buying it. And that's when all of this happened. This just took off. And there was one game designer named Howard Warshaw. And he figures pretty prominently in this documentary from Zach Penn, because he designed one of the first games to sell a gob ton of copies. It's called Yar's Revenge. You remember that one?
Oh, yeah, actually.
He designed that one, and that became the gold standard at the time. It was one of the most popular games that Atari ever put out. And that led to movie adaptations, franchise tie-in video games.
Mm-hmm.
He designed the Raiders of the Lost Ark video game for Atari.
Mm, right.
And that led to E.T.
Hmm.
Now, the timing on this, you have to watch this sometime. The timing on it was such that E.T. came out, is a huge hit, because it's Spielberg and it's E.T. and everybody loves it, right? And so now we have to have a video game. And we have to have a video game in time for the Christmas market.
Right.
Howard Warshaw only had... Now, normally, a video game like this back in the day, you're talking 5 or 6 months.
Yeah, that sounds about right, yeah.
Warshaw had 5 weeks...
Yeah, that always works out well.
Right.
I just turned out editing on a film because I thought the time frame was too short, and I wasn't even getting there were no expectations of, like, you know, tie into one of the biggest films of the decade.
Well, and Warshaw basically lived in his office, lived where he worked. He lived at his desk that entire time, and he cranked this thing out, and at the time people thought it was a great piece of work. All things considered, it probably was. I don't know that anybody else, just looking at what everybody else said about what was going on at the time, I don't know that anybody but Warshaw could have done it to begin with. So they give it to him. He does the game. Spielberg's impressed with it. They roll out for Christmas. And there's apparently enough of a backlash on this game because it's so difficult, darn near impossible to get through the entire run of the game and find all the Easter eggs. You know, Indiana Jones is in that game.
Really?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And so is Yar. These little Easter eggs. Because, you know, when you know, E.T. drops down into the pit, there's always something there. And so when E.T. would retrieve these things, you'd have different things show up.
Sure.
Well, the game didn't sell as well as anybody expected it to. And because of that, that was the slippery slope, the beginning of it. Everything nosedived from there. All the profit projections were off and the market share went down and everything collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, everybody likes to blame E.T. And
sure.
Subsequently, They blame Warshaw. Warshaw ended up getting out of the industry altogether after this. And he's now a psychologist, therapist person out in California somewhere. Hmm. He got out of the gaming industry altogether because he couldn't get work. Because everybody blamed him for the collapse, when it was one of those things where, and even in hindsight now, people like to bash that game. And it's almost a thing where people like to bash the game without ever having played the game.
Right.
It's a Me Too-ism.
Yeah.
And some of the people they talked to on this documentary, they said, that game really wasn't all that bad. It was difficult. There was a challenge to it. But, 5 weeks to do what you normally take 6 months to do, that's an impossible task. But it's a really, really fascinating piece. I do recommend it. It's called Atari Game Over. It's from Zach Penn, who is actually working on the screenplay for Ready Player One.
Oh, right.
With Ernie Klein.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually got a chance to talk to Ernie. We interviewed him in Dallas. Was that 3 years ago now? Was it 2011, 2012? We'll link to it. But, we got a chance to talk to Ernie about Ready Player One. This is back before he had the movie deal. So it's been a while. But that leads us into other games of the 80s. What was your favorite Atari game? You're talking about Lode Runner. What else?
Oh, wow.
What games did you play?
Oh, like I said, more than anything, there was a funny little period there where most of my friends, very few of us actually had the home video games.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all our arcade stuff. We were more the arcade kids.
Right.
In fact, do you remember the old... A lot of people, because you still see them. Remember the Star Wars game that was basically
The wireframe stand up.
Okay,
I love that game. Okay. I want to get one of those.
Do you remember the Star Trek one?
Vaguely.
Okay.
Vaguely.
Played a lot of the Star Trek one.
Yeah.
At the arcade. Tron later.
Yeah.
A lot of Tron. Remember when? Oh, for heaven's sake! What was the animated one?
Dragon's Lair.
Where
that was a huge change.
Oh, yeah.
in the industry right then.
And incredibly expensive.
Yeah, and
so many cutscenes.
That was the first. That was the first. I guess a multi-track, really.
Yeah.
In terms of the game engine, reading where you go.
What was the science fiction version of that? There was a. Yeah, there was two. There was this fantasy one, and then there was a science fiction one.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know that I ever heard about the other one.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
But yeah, Dragon's Lair was it was a Laserdisc video game. I think it was one of the first ones that used the Laserdisc technology. And for those of you who don't know, Laserdiscs are giant DVDs. They're the same.
Yes.
They're the same size as these things that are showing up now in the electronic stores called vinyl. These albums that people talk about now. Some of you may be seeing them for the very first time ever.
Quality really is better.
Oh yeah, it is. It is much better. And so these things are about 12 inches in diameter. And I've still got my Star Wars trilogy on Laserdisc.
Sure.
And, of course, you can't fit the whole movie on one side of the disc. It's, I think Empire takes up three discs, three sides. So I always, whenever I'm watching the VCR version.
Sure.
As soon as Luke says to R2... I've got a promise to keep to an old friend. And then you have the shot of the X-Wing spinning away.
Right.
That's the cut point where you flip the disc.
Oh, okay, sure.
And so every time I see the X-Wing pull away from the camera, I'm like, all right, time to flip the disc. Because I watched it so many times. I know that's where the disc flips. But yeah, the Dragon's Lair was a Laserdisc video game. So basically, when you walked through when you did your part of the video game itself, you did your action sequences, did whatever you needed to do as the character in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on where you went next, it would determine what pieces of animation. And I think was it Don Bluth that did that stuff?
I think it was.
Yeah, animation by ex-Disney animator Don Bluth, because I remember it looking so much like The Secret of NIMH.
What year was that?
And Pagemaster.
What year did that come out?
Dragon's Lair, 1983.
Yeah. Yeah.
Weren't they going to do a movie adaptation at one point of Dragon's Lair?
I thought they were.
Who would you get to play Dirk the Daring? Who could do it now?
Oh, see, 10 years ago you would have gotten. 15, 20 years ago they would have cast
Bruce Campbell. Bruce Campbell.
Well, Bruce Campbell now, yeah.
Yeah, to get the chin. I mean,
of course,
Dirk the Daring has the chin. That's all about the chin.
Well, there was actually the cartoon series.
You know, I don't remember the entire, the very first time, as it were, but I remember
Space Ace.
When
that was the name of the, that was the name of the science,
Ace,
science
fiction. Right, that's right. Yeah. I remember the first time I saw Dragon's Lair in the arcade.
Mm-hmm.
I remember walking up and seeing this cartoon playing over the arcade stuff.
Right.
What are they doing with cartoons here? And then I realized, wait a minute, that's part of the game.
Prior to that, you were looking at the big games. The big games were Frogger and Asteroids.
Asteroids.
And Space Invaders.
Mm. I don't even think Pac-Man was out Pac-Man was out when Dragon's Lair came out. Yeah.
Time Pilot. Remember Time Pilot?
No.
It was a flying game. You were the pilot of a plane. You were flying through different time periods and stuff like that. So you fought all kinds of interesting cross-generational, cross-century enemies.
It was Galaga.
Star Trek was a Sega game, and it came out in 82.
Ah.
That's the one.
Right.
And 83 was Star Wars. So it was like just back to back. I mean,
I played that stand-up Star Wars game all the time, chance I got. And I remember where it was too. It was in a Chuck E. Cheese's. It was the first Chuck E. Cheese's that came into to the Irving area, in the Dallas area, and it was because I remember we got my sixth grade reading class.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the circumstances were, but we ended up going to Chuck E. Cheese's for a party of some sort.
Yeah.
And I spent most of my time on that Star Trek game, or the Star Wars game, and my teacher had to come get me.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I can't, this is the teacher I had a crush on.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so I was like, I'm fine, you come get me.
there is at the Town East Mall in Wichita, there is a video arcade game there now. And I want to say that I can't remember when the Town East Mall was built. So the arcade that is there now was not the first arcade. There was an earlier one. But there was another arcade in town. There was some other place. We certainly played a lot of video games at the Godfather's Pizza.
Sure.
Was one of the ones there. I've been in a Chuck E. Cheese's exactly once in my life. I'm pretty sure I'm okay with that.
Well, see, and they weren't as bad as they are now in terms of quality.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they were new. Mm-hmm. This was a brand new thing.
Right.
You know, it's a new franchise that came in and all of that. And it's very much like any of those massive family entertainment complexes
right.
that you've got now.
Sure.
But it was one of the first ones.
Yeah.
And so it got time to set the precedence and make their mark and
slide downhill.
Stamp the world and then slide down.
Right.
But you remember Chuck E. Cheese, the mouse,
mm-hmm.
originally was this hard-bitten rock and roller type.
Right.
You remember that?
Yeah.
And now he's not.
No, he's cuddly now.
Yes.
Or something. Remember when the last Starfighter was supposed to be a game?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and everybody kept waiting for it to come out. When's it going to come out? I'm still waiting for the sequel.
Well, you know what they say.
They keep talking about it.
Yeah, but they're talking more about a reboot than a sequel.
Yeah, see, I don't
know if you can't... You'd have to come up with a very interesting take on it, because one of the things about that film was that it is a product of the arcade.
Yeah.
And yes, there is a resurgence of arcade games.
But still, you've got, with all the massive multiplayer online gaming and all this role-playing games and stuff. I see it probably like they did with the second War Games. They did the War Games sequel. They did online gaming as the test to find people and candidates and whatnot. I think they'll probably do something like that. But I think a sequel would be much more interesting, because you could do the Man Out of Time story.
Oh, sure.
Because when he goes off into space, he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes back, and the technology, his point of reference is different.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so, Alex and Maggie both.
Right.
When they come back, they go, what is all this? What? You're Game walking around Boy. With a computer in your hand? What's going on?
What are you playing on your phone?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very true. But, it's much more likely somebody will try and do a complete reboot.
Yeah, which is sad. What happens. You got to do a sequel. Yeah. Sequels are much more fun.
Well, but I think they're afraid, because sequels to films that are more than a few years old.
Tron Legacy did okay.
It did okay, and it's like they're getting a third film, but at the same time, it's not like Star Wars. Star Wars captures the generations. You can have a sequel to a film that's, that there's that much space in between.
Although, I think we'd be much less likely that we'd be getting The Force Awakens if we had not had Clone Wars and Rebels and the prequels. If it had just been the first three,
mm-hmm.
and now you're doing seven, with nothing in between to fill the gap, other than maybe some tie-in books and some whatnot. Like, I don't think it would have as much of a draw.
No.
As it does now, because you've had you've got generations hitting at very different places with Star Wars.
Even if they did, it would still be a very different thing, because you have kept that audience all this time.
And by the way, if anybody wants to send us the stand-up Star Wars cabinet with working electronics inside it, I won't turn it down.
Oh well, no, I wouldn't imagine you would.
Wouldn't that be fun? See, I've always thought at some point, once we get an office, mm-hmm. that we populate it with a few video games. We gotta have our own arcade.
Oh, of course.
Because that's such a staple of our fandom community. Well, and how many, you talk about the last Starfighter being centered around a video game. How many times did we see video games, video game arcades in movies of that time? Tron.
Oh yeah.
Lost Boys.
Mm-hmm.
What else? I mean, half the time anybody was anywhere, they were at an arcade.
Oh yeah, cool. Well, there were social places to be too. I mean, they were, if you were too young to go to a bar.
Yeah.
But they were also a little bit disreputable.
Yeah.
So you could hang out, if you're a teenager, you could hang out at the arcade and be like,
with a pocket full of quarters.
Exactly. And there'd always be that, there'd be the guy who was like always just the incredible guy. He was the player who nobody could beat him. And it's just like, it was, and if you're below a certain age, all of this sounds really, really odd, because...
Yeah, because there is nothing. What would be the modern day equivalent of something like that? Because you don't even have the malls to go to anymore.
No, I mean, like the malls have essentially been dying. But the video arcades are coming back, so I don't know. But the video arcades are cool now. I mean, they were cool then, but I mean, it doesn't have the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is anything like that. I mean, we've, and if you are a teenager, perhaps you can enlighten the old men. Because yeah, I don't really have anything like that.
I don't know that there is.
Because so much of that stuff moved online.
Right.
And, you know, but what's kind of cool about the return of the arcade is that it is a social, it is, in some respects, it is a social thing, too. So, you know, we transitioned to the online world for a lot of things, but it's another place that you can kind of take that and step back into being a, hey, we'll play this game together, but we're physically next to each other. Or my quarter is on here, so you got to let me play after you die.
Or you're, you know, it's a two-player game.
Oh, yeah.
And you're playing at the same time together. In the same thing.
But it's also something you're not doing at home.
Right.
So, I mean, because obviously we've got your Nintendo and GameCube and Xbox and all the whole, you know, the whole range of different video game home systems. So you can sit there and play with your friends at home. But this is a much more public, very social thing. You interact with people you don't know in a way that you're certainly doing with online gaming. But
it's kind of like conventions. You've got a bunch of people that don't know each other, but they have a shared interest. Mm-hmm. And they understand each other.
Right.
And for the most part, you're not going to give each other a hard time unless...
There'll be some trash talk.
Yeah.
There's always trash talk.
But it is interesting to see the resurgence of the arcade, the vinyl albums. I'm wondering at some point if we're going to actually get film cameras coming back or Polaroid.
Well, I'll tell you what, having recently picked up a 1920... film camera. Dual 8.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that Bell and Howell you picked up?
Yeah. And.
Those are good cameras.
Well, and it claims that it works.
Wow.
So.
Good luck finding film.
Well, it'll take 16 mil because it was the Dual 8 was.
Right.
Was,
yeah, right.
So. So yeah, I have to track some down.
Wow!
Because I'd like to see if it actually works.
See, and I've got two Kodak Brownie C's, like the really old ones that they carried around in the war.
Right.
And these are hand crank.
Sure.
They don't run off a battery or anything. You crank them up and they roll.
Yeah, this is a hand crank.
And I think as the best I can tell, they both still work.
Yeah. Oh.
It's just. You can't ever find. There's no film for it.
Right.
Nobody ever makes it.
What we're talking about, folks, is vintage cameras. This is stuff that was made
in the 40s.
Well,
the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, the one that I picked up is a 1920 something. They made a whole range of these cameras everywhere from the kind of thing you could fit if and they marketed them as such, the kind of thing a woman could fit into her purse, all the way up to a full size. What you would imagine, you know, 2 or 3 feet big film camera for making a motion picture.
Yeah. And I remember...
And they were... The work on the cases, a lot of times... Some are very utilitarian. The one that I have is very utilitarian. But some of them were just gorgeous, ornate, metalworking, amazing stuff.
They were built to last.
Oh, yeah.
Because we were using... When I was in college the first time back in 19... it was... We had some Airy 16s, 16S, 16SR, but we also had some old Bell & Howell that had been used, I think had been used back as far back as World War II.
Sure.
And they were still solid, still good cameras.
They were made to actually take a beating.
Yeah.
Actually, they were solid pieces of tech.
Yeah, because back in those days, you didn't have videotape, so all of the news... Well, even as late as the 60s, early 70s, all of the news was shot on film.
Yeah.
You know, you'd have to go out, and if you're shooting an interview with somebody or if you're shooting an event or something like Kennedy assassination not like you're going to the planned event as a Kennedy assassination,
right.
But, you know.
Generally speaking, do not go to planned assassinations.
Right.
It's a bad idea.
But you know, like when Lee Harvey Oswald was being transferred away from prison and he got shot,
right?
Any kind of news event, the Olympics or an election or any of that, or even local news,
you know,
interview the mayor. It was all shot on film,
sure.
And they'd have to bring it back and process it and print it and roll it up, and then it would end up on videotape, at some point down the road, but it wouldn't originate that way.
Right.
And everything, all of the big archive footage that you see from World War I, World War II, Korea, and a lot of that stuff was used, you know, George Lucas used it as reference material for the dogfights.
Sure. Yep.
All of that shot on film.
Yeah.
And it makes me somewhat hopeful that we see the arcades coming back, we see vinyl coming back, that maybe at some point we see film come back and Kodak recovers a little bit.
I think the deciding factor of bringing film back is going to be processing cost. If someone can figure out a way to make the processing cost not be so prohibitively expensive.
Yeah.
Because here in KC, we do, the Independent Filmmakers Coalition used to do...
the Bentleys.
The Bentleys. And this was actually the Bentley being a kind of camera for the kids at home. But it's a silent camera. There's no sound. You can't shoot sound.
Right.
With it. And the whole point of the Bentley competition was that you shot the entire film in camera. You weren't allowed to edit.
Yeah, so you'd have to shoot it in sequence.
You have to shoot it in sequence, and nobody does. And you'd basically have to. And the thing is that you would never actually see your film until we screened it. You would take the film, and we would send the film off to a lab to have it developed, and they would send it back to us. And that'd be it. What you saw on the day of the screening is what you got.
Yeah.
Which makes for some very, very, it made you be very, very creative and plan. Plan,
yeah.
Plot, and figure it out, because otherwise you don't have any idea what you're going to get anyway. But you know, so the only reason we stopped doing that was the cost. It became so prohibitive financially
Nowadays, with everything being so digital,
yeah.
You know, you shoot it with a camera and you can immediately see it and see what you've got. And
which has some real pros. I mean, it's made a lot of what we can do with our film stuff a lot easier. However,
I also think that it has made filmmakers sloppy because, this is our divergence for the week, I guess. This is one of those things where if you just shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot, then you know, you've got all of this footage that's completely useless, one, and it's wasted everybody's time. If you don't plan meticulously because you have limited resources, you know, that can affect your process. And I remember when I shot my movie, knowing that I only had a certain amount of time.
Right.
And that particular movie I shot on videotape. Mm-hmm. I shot on mini DV tape. It's still a quote-unquote digital file at the point where it enters into the computer, but it originated on tape, and I've only got so much tape, and the tape costs money.
Well,
so that thing, and the principle is the same as it would be if you're shooting film stock, because film stock, they come in 400-foot rolls, and that's 10 minutes, and that's all you got.
Right.
And you can't rewind it and shoot over again.
Well, you can.
Well, yeah, but that's an effect completely different from what you're trying to achieve.
Exactly.
I keep wondering if maybe film will come back with everything else, because you know, with Tron moving forward with the new sequel, and you know, talk about Last Starfighter, because every now and then Last Starfighter will just percolate to the top, and now we've got Gremlins coming.
Oh yeah,
you know, the Gremlins reboot. The 80s are a hot thing.
Well, but we've talked about this before. A lot of it is the folks like us. Are in positions of power in the entertainment industry now. And
where's ours?
We are clearly in positions of power of some kind. But I'll tell you what,
maybe compared to the rabbit out front, but
you know what else is in a position of power?
Mm.
The fine folks over at superherostuff.com, because they have all the cool stuff, which means they are the ones you've got to go to get all the cool stuff.
That's right. And we are going to break late.
Yes, we are.
because you get to talking about this stuff and you can just keep going. Okay, yes, we are going to take a break, let you hear from superherostuff.com. They have all sorts of cool items that tie in with franchises and such. And we will be right back with more discussion of the 80s when H2O continues. Stand by.
You're listening to H2O on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Where can you get Age of Ultron stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
Where can you get Justice League stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
Where can you get Doctor Who stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
Where can you get Daredevil stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
New items being added all the time. Get your superhero stuff at SuperheroStuff.com. Plus, the Hero Box is back. $70 worth of superhero stuff for only $49. SuperheroStuff.com, where heroes shop.
Hi, this is Jason Hunt, and if you're one of the dedicated listeners for this show, first of all, thank you. Second, you are sharing with others, are you not? And you should be aware by now, we have many shows as part of Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Our Marvel discussion on Level 117, the DC chat on the Rogues Gallery, Sci-Fi for Chicks talking about various topics, which we also do in mixed company on the Echo Chamber, and H2O, which is our one-on-one discussion between Mr. Harvey and myself, now syndicated over at Amazing Stories Magazine. Sci-Fi for Me Radio is more than one show, and we'd like to invite you to join us for all of it, or at least try it out and see what you think. And also check out Sci-Fi for Me TV, that's our YouTube channel, where we have interviews, convention panel video, and Week in Review, where we deliver a digest of the news of the week. All part of giving you the most bang for your buck. Oh yeah, wait, no, it's free. So check it out, Sci-Fi for Me Radio and Sci-Fi for Me TV, all part of SciFiForMe.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
Our transmitters are made from hand-wavium. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Back on H2O, Jason Hunt here, along with Timothy Harvey.
Hello.
And we're talking games from the 80s. You remember Merlin?
Merlin.
The little red handheld. Boop, boop, boop,
oh,
boop,
wow.
Boop,
yeah, sure.
That came out then. Simon. Mm-hmm. Simon was one. Risk.
With
Axis
Risk?
And Allies.
Yeah, well, you know what? The 80s. The 70s were a huge time for games, but the 80s were our teenage years.
Yeah.
So this is the time we were playing it. But I mean, you look at the 70s, and you had Dungeons and Dragons in 74.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that one more time. Dungeons and Dragons, 1974. It's that old.
I was in fifth grade. I was 10. Mm-hmm. This would have been 1980, mm-hmm. when I got introduced to Dungeons and Dragons. Messed me up, I will admit, because by the time I got over to sixth grade, seventh grade, I wanted a different name. Like, yeah, everybody knew it was a phase that I was going through, and they were said, but it was funny, I had an English teacher. It was sixth grade. I had an English teacher who looked right at me and says, I absolutely refuse to call you anything other than your actual name.
Yeah. Remember when Dungeons and Dragons was like the scary thing?
Oh yeah, it was the boogeyman.
Like, oh,
it was the boogeyman.
There's actually did you see that film that somebody actually made
with Tom Hanks?
No, the current one, the one where they've actually
I heard about it.
It's the whole scare tactic Dungeons and Dragons. It opens the door to all these terrible things. It's like kids, it's a game. Interestingly enough, in 71 there was a game called Chainmail. This was the very first game. This was pretty much the very first role-playing game.
Right.
And it was medieval warfare.
Mm.
And there was like a 10-page supplement that dealt with fantasy stuff. It was just an afterthought.
We'll add that in.
You know, 3 years later, Dungeons and Dragons hits. And it set everything off. But 78 was Gamma World, which was one of the big first really huge science fiction games. Star Trek, one of the first Star Trek games came out in 78. But Traveller, the other big science fiction one. 1980, 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Top Secret. 81, the first Call of Cthulhu game. Thieves World. 82, Behind Enemy Lines. Pirates and Plunder.
Oh, yeah.
Starfleet Voyages. Star Trek the role-playing game. What was it? What was the other one? James Bond. 007. Let's see here. 84 was The Adventures of Indiana Jones. Elf Quest.
Yeah, I remember ElfQuest.
Marvel Superheroes, the first Marvel Superheroes role-playing game. Middle Earth. Ringworld. If some of these names are ringing bells, like things like Ringworld, yes, that's the Larry Niven one.
Right.
There was a role-playing game. Challengers, Conan, DC Heroes, Doctor Who role-playing game. These are 85. Judge Dredd.
See, and it's very telling that a lot of those games came and went very quickly.
Oh, they did. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, 85.
How long? Is Car Wars still around?
You know what? That's a really
good question. Has Car Wars eventually evolved into Grand Theft Auto?
Well, no, because if Grand Theft Auto had the same trick, you were to trick out your cars the way they were in Car Wars, the bloodbath would be much, much bigger.
Yeah, it'd be more like Death Race.
Which would actually be kind of awesome. I mean, if you're going to... And you know what? That actually kind of...
That could be a DLC, you know, GTA, Car Wars.
Well, here's the thing. Why isn't there a Death Race 2000 video game?
That's a good question.
Why is this? Is it a rights thing? Because, I mean, that would be...
I would imagine it's probably a rights thing more than anything else.
Because that doesn't make... I mean, because other than that, I mean, that is a game that is... I mean, first of all, it's a racing game.
Yeah.
And racing games are, you know, continue to be very, very popular. But it's a racing game with a bit of a twist.
And it's kind of a slightly different twist depending on which movie you're basing it on.
Oh, no, we go off the original. You
what about a Running Man video game?
Now, see...
That would be...
If you would do a Running Man video game based more on the story versus the film, because the film was really kind of a watered down. It was very much a Schwarzenegger picture versus the dark. Car Wars was 1980.
Was it really? Did it come? It came out that early.
Came out in 1980.
When did Top Secret was out in what, 80 as well? 79?
Top Secret was 80 as well, yeah.
I remember, and I may still have it somewhere, I remember drawing a map of an island. I created an island, and the island had a facility on it. Because I was gonna, I was designing a campaign. I was designing a mission, in Top Secret, and you should see this. You should see the map of this island. It's gorgeous because all of the little inlets and coves and details. I was actually looking at maps to see, you know, the cartography of actual real maps. So this thing actually would look like what you'd find on a map. And got really, really detailed with all of the stuff, you know, trees here and cove here and harbor here and all this.
Right.
And designing the facility where they're supposed to infiltrate and all that. And I had a blast. It was fun. Top Secret for me though, I never could find enough people really to get anything going with that. Everybody was interested in D&D, but not Top Secret. My cousin and I did a lot of Car Wars when I visited him in Arkansas, but nobody really had much interest in the Top Secret game among the people that I knew.
No, I don't. I think I looked at the gaming stuff, that stuff for times, and I think some of that probably came out years later when I was starting to do cons. Because you'd come up, you'd pay, you know, you'd check out the gaming stuff. Car Wars had a compendium in 2009. The website apparently says that they've got a new version coming out.
But really?
It's been sitting there in limbo for a while.
You know, now I do want to see Grand Theft Auto Car Wars.
I know.
I think that would be so fun.
The last novel, there were three novels from Tor Books set in the Car Wars universe. The last one was 1999. Wow.
Pixar, Car Wars.
Oh, I mean, listen to some of these titles. I love this stuff. First edition, Car Wars. Sunday Drivers, Crash City, 1982. Truck Stop, Auto Duel Champions. Boat Wars.
There you go.
Which expanded it to the water, obviously.
Sure.
Auto Duel, Uncle Albert's Catalog from Hell. Which, as you remember, Uncle Albert's was the, if I remember right, that
was
where
you they got all your stuff. Yeah.
And so you wanted to put that Gatling gun on top of your car?
Here you go.
Here's the catalog.
That's
so
funny.
Oh, it was great. Wow, that was really kind of a blast of stuff to play.
But you know one we haven't mentioned yet?
Mm.
Starfleet Battles.
Well, I did mention it, but I mentioned it in passing. And we, God, that was a great game.
It was. I remember.
I still have in my apartment, in the closet, I have a box that has my Starfleet Battles books and my Star Trek the Role-Playing Game books. I'm pretty sure. Oh, I know it.
You may have to dig that stuff out.
At least my Star Trek the Role-Playing Game stuff. I think maybe Starfleet Battle stuff is in there, too.
When I was in ninth grade,
mm-hmm.
David Parsons and I, he does some of our CG animation here on mm-hmm. the site. He and I have known each other since, we've known each other since seventh grade. So in ninth grade, freshman year in high school, we meet some other guys who are interested in this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they invited us over for a Starfleet Battles campaign. The map was huge.
Oh, yeah.
It took up most of the dining table at the house where we were. And it was my first overnight gaming experience.
Mm-hmm.
It was Saturday. I went over on a Saturday evening, and we started about 6:30, 7 o'clock, and we went until the morning, Sunday morning.
Sure.
And I got picked up when we went to church, but they were still going. You know, the game was still going. It wasn't over yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd gone at least a good 12 hours.
Yeah.
And hadn't finished.
Oh yeah.
Those things got intricate. I mean, that game, those role-playing games really do suck you in when it's done right.
It's a game that you could really, it's like any good game. You know, you get involved, you're playing with your friends, you're using the rules of the game to find something that is just a, okay, we'll give an example here. For us, we built a giant campaign. It was the Doomsday Machine versus everybody else. And so we basically took the time to design the Starfleet Battles version of the Doomsday Machine, which, for those of you who ever played Starfleet Battles, means it had all the armor in the world. It had all the weapons in the world. And, of course, everything's focused out the front, right? So, because, I mean, that's where the...
Right.
And so we basically built this. I mean, this thing was gigantic. And it would have taken probably the table that I'm sitting at right now, which is a fairly long table, probably half of the table was the Doomsday Machine. I mean, it was just this gigantic thing.
Wow.
And then it was the Federation, the Klingons, and the Tholians, because my friend Calvin was a big fan of the Tholians. And it was all-out war against the Doomsday Machine, against the three fleets. And your standard ships that they provided for Star, that you do, sort of your basic, you know, this is the Constitution class, this is your D7
right.
class, this is your Tholian ship. But we also had dreadnoughts. We designed dreadnoughts, which were these ridiculously overpowered ships. I mean, we're talking like, so you want to blow up a star? Is that the goal? And we just threw them at this thing, and it was days and days and days of just damage being done to these ships.
Yeah.
Get to the end, the Doomsday Machine is, we finally take it out, we're all just broken and bleeding, and our ships are just, you know, everything's gone but the dreadnoughts, because
right.
they're built to just take everything. And my friend Calvin and I ganged up on my friend Kenny, and we, yeah, so it was the Federation, the Tholians versus the Klingons, and it's like, yes! And Kenny was like, hang on! I thought we were all in on this together. It's like, but it was so much fun. And what's interesting is that you look at some of the stuff, the 90s is a whole different ballpark
in
terms of games.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's just that the tone, it becomes a lot more, I don't know, it's broader, to be sure, but you're looking at stuff like Vampire the Masquerade. So you're branching more into your fantasy
right.
stuff becomes a little more fantasy horror, which is fine. But you get some really weird ones. The Adventures of Baron Munchausen in 1998. What? Mage, which again was a Wizard of the Coast.
Right.
The Wizard of the Coast exploded in the 90s. And yeah. They had a lot of great stuff. They had the Werewolf.
And they're still going.
Oh, yeah. They had the... well, they were the White Wolf.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they ended up with the Dungeons and Dragons license.
Sure.
They have it now.
But you had Vampire, the Dragonlance books and the Dragonlance games.
Oh, that's right. That was them.
So that blew up. Wow, yeah. Werewolf the Apocalypse. A lot more Star Trek stuff. DC and Marvel started to roll more stuff out. There was a whole bunch of Star Trek games. Deep Space Nine and Star Trek the Original Series role-playing game. Weird War II. Street Fighter, the role-playing game.
Street Fighter,
it's right there. It's a 1994. I never played it. Clearly, it made an impression. But a lot of things that just really expanded. I mean, of course, the 90s, you see a lot of your more conspiracy, Men in Black, X-Files-ish games.
Right.
And when I say Men in Black, I mean not the comedy movie series, but the actual just sort of, you know, mysterious, you know.
The strangers with the black helicopters.
Right.
And,
so,
and, yeah.
But you see a lot of TV stuff, you know, Hercules and Xena, you know, Star Trek, the Next Generation, specific stuff too.
Sure.
But yeah, it was a different time. But the 80s was just, wow, the 80s have got so many Robotech, Mutazoids.
Oh,
Mutazoids? I go by wow.
Well, and Robotech is now, if I remember right, Robotech is in development over at Sony.
Yeah, yeah.
A new movie.
For good or for ill.
What's old is new again.
Yeah, well, Warhammer. Isn't there supposed to be a Warhammer movie in the works?
You know, I want to say that there is.
I thought I heard there was one in the works.
Yeah, there's World of Warcraft, and I think there is a Warhammer movie.
Yeah, I know Warcraft was coming, but I thought Warhammer was too.
I think that's right. I don't know.
But it's just, I mean, so many of these games, and they came along at the right time, because this is when, for a lot of this generation, you're in my generation, the convention circuit exploded.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could go to play these games, these tabletop games,
right,
with people from all over the place.
And like you mentioned, we didn't have the internet and computers and all of that like we've got now.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very much a social engagement where you actually are in the room with other people.
Oh yeah,
and you all have the same interest mm-hmm. and such. Yeah, it's very different environment now. Although we do see a lot of that coming back, because we saw at Planet Comic Con, we had not only the electronic gaming room,
mm-hmm.
but also the tabletop room. And Will Wheaton's got his show on Geek & Sundry, Tabletop, where they play a lot of role-playing games as well.
Right.
I think we're seeing a resurgence in that, as well as a resurgence in video arcades and vinyl. There's this, I don't know, this wave of nostalgia that's...
Well, I think
flowing over the country.
A lot of it is definitely a nostalgia, but I think there's also a fact that there's a recognition that just because you can do these other things doesn't mean you have to leave this other stuff behind.
Yeah, there's a value that somebody has decided to attach to it that they think they can still make some money on it.
Well, that too, but I think, you know, it's like my dad, one of the things my dad asked for Christmas was one of those new record players that you can basically, you know, mm-hmm. take your CDs and, you know, basically play them on your record player.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it's just like, okay, that's kind of cool, but you can plug your record player into your computer.
Yeah. And record the tracks.
Yeah. So yeah. I think that,
even though we don't encourage copyright violations.
Well, sorry. Right. Of course not. But, but you can do it.
Yeah.
But the thing is that he has a working turntable again, and he was happy about that because my dad's got an extensive record collection. Now my dad is of a generation where, mm-hmm. you know, records was what it was.
And I've got a lot. I've got over 445,
mm-hmm.
and I got a turntable for Christmas. Was it last year?
Mm-hmm.
Year before last? Maybe a year before last. And the first thing I did is I got the my copy of the 1812 Overture,
mm-hmm.
that I lifted from my dad's collection, and he is aware that I have it.
All right.
But this is Eugene Ormandy conducting the Philadelphia Harmonic Orchestra, I believe, is who it is. I'd have to go back and look. From 1959.
Yeah.
And it's still pristine. I mean, my dad takes care of stuff. Yeah. And I take care of it. And so, of course, that's the first thing that I put on there. And, you know, it's 17 and a half minutes long.
Sure.
We're saying that, and, of course, I made my kid listen. You know, listen to this. This is what a turntable does, right?
Right.
And, of course, now you've got the Guardians of the Galaxy mix, number one,
mm-hmm.
out on vinyl. Well, so that, you know, that hit the turntable pretty quick.
Oh,
but
sure.
Then I have a copy of Hooked on a Feeling on a 45. So I dropped it in there and didn't tell James what it was, and I put it in there, and all of a sudden, you know, ooga chaka, you know, and he just looked at me. He's like, "What else is in here?" And he's rifling through all the 45s and stuff. It's fun because you get to connect with people that you don't otherwise.
Well, and there was also a thing. I think, you know, vinyl doesn't have the replacement. The ease of replacement that CDs does, and certainly it doesn't have the ease of replacement of a digital file. I mean, there was only so many pressings.
Yeah.
Of and that's what they used to call it, folks. They used to press the discs. There were only so many of those, and so you could sit there and that's why people go to record stores, looking for that elusive title because there's only so many of them.
I spent years looking for the soundtrack to Silverado.
Mm.
Finally found it on a CD. Now this is after, you know, CDs had become the thing.
Sure.
At this point. So I am looking for a CD, but I understand that search for a particular thing because nobody had that. Nobody had the Silverado soundtrack.
And there is a certain
ever to find
if it. if you're a collector of anything.
Yeah.
There's a certain amount of fun to the hunt. For it,
mm-hmm.
you know, the fact that you can sit there and go, oh, I didn't find it, but I found this instead. I mean, there's something about that as a collector.
Or when somehow you end up with a bunch of albums
mm-hmm.
from somebody else's collection, or
sure.
just somehow you come across all this stuff, and you discover what you actually have in your hand.
Yeah.
Fleetwood Mac's Rumours.
Yeah.
I have one of the real ones, not the reprints that
are
out now.
Sure.
The Led Zeppelin album with the Hindenburg on the front. Yeah. I got that.
Yeah.
I didn't know I had that. I got Led Zeppelin. This is the first one.
Yeah.
You know, it's Zeppelin. So it is fun to have all of that.
And although many, many people cannot tell the difference, there are people who certainly swear that they can, and I'm gonna agree that personally to me vinyl sounds better.
Yeah, agreed. I think so too.
And I think that some of that is I think there's two things involved. One, we're listening to a lot more music on speakers that are not designed for listening to music on. The computer speakers on my computers, both computers, are good speakers. But they're designed for computers.
Mm-hmm.
They're not meant to be, they're not surround sound. They're not even a good set of speakers. And my grandfather used to run a Zenith repair shop. Upstairs was the hobby shop, and mm-hmm. downstairs was a Zenith repair shop, and he did more than just repair Zeniths. But this is back in the day when you took your television to the repair shop when it stopped working. You took your radio to the repair shop when it stopped working, because these things were meant to last, and therefore if it stopped working, somebody had replacement parts, and you just took it in, and the professional
mm-hmm.
fixed it. And the disposable product economy had not emerged.
Right.
Thank you, 1980s. and for good and for ill. I mean, neither one of us has any desire to do this because it's still an expense that we don't want to pay. But if we had to replace our computers, we could do it.
Yeah.
Versus going, I'd like to mortgage the home to replace my computer.
Exactly.
But you would still have, you would get those really good sets of speakers, and you still have them. You can still buy them. They're out there. You're going to pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
But you put the really good speakers on, and you put a really good set of headphones, there is some quality differences there. And you put vinyl on, and there's a Is warmth the word I want?
Yep.
The warmth.
It's exactly the way I would describe it too.
And I don't know. It's just maybe it's just the difference between the mediums. I mean, I'm not knocking a digital format for anything, mm-hmm. because digital is. I mean, the ability to get that information out, to the convenience of it, the speed of it, and the relative low price of digital anything, has been great for entertainment, and for people getting to hear things they wouldn't get to hear.
Right.
But I have no problems with vinyl coming back. I really
don't. Yeah.
But we're not going to see that same resurgent with CDs or cassettes or 8-tracks. Sorry, your 8-track collecting folks. 8-tracks. I mean, I guarantee you there is a company, at least one company out there selling 8-tracks right now. I guarantee it. There's at least one.
I would think that if anybody were to have the market on it, it would either be Rhino or it would be La La Land. One of those two.
Is K-Tel still around?
Oh, that's got me thinking.
Uh-oh.
We should do a promo.
Oh wow! In the style of K-Tel.
The style of K-Tel. We're gonna have to look at
and,
that.
And there's a section of the audience that have no idea what K. Okay, folks, for the kids at home, K-Tel was. God, this was the early days of cable. Because I don't think we got. Did we get K-Tel? Wasn't K-Tel kind of exploded on cable? Because that was a place where you'd get the. Maybe it was before that.
Well, yeah, as seen on TV. I mean, it was one of the original ones.
But it was all the collections of your favorite love songs, the favorite love songs from K-Tel. And it was inevitably you would order. It was the whole order something, and then you'd suddenly find yourself getting another one, and another one, and another one, and another one. It was the publisher's clearinghouse of music. Oh, wow. Just some amazing stuff. God.
And we could go on about that forever.
We could. I mean, one of these days we're going to sit down and probably break down all the weird things that came out of this whole explosion that many of them, thankfully, are no longer here. Do not miss K-Tel.
It's still around.
I'm sure. Oh,
it's
God,
still
I'm
around.
Sure.
It's now the whole digital stuff.
Yeah, sure.
You know, they're you know, product of the time, and mm-hmm. they you know have evolved as everybody else has. But yeah, it's still a thing. But yeah, we need to do that. We need to do a promo in the style of K-Tel.
Oh wow, yeah, we got
to
do that.
Yeah, add that to the list. Okay, that's going to do it for us tonight. If you've got a favorite game, if you were even around back then.
Or, you know what, a favorite game now, that's true, because the role play, we focused a little on video games and tabletop games, but, you know, the arcade games are coming back, and the tabletop games have never really gone away.
Right.
But if there's something that you're playing now, the game that is really, you know, exciting you, and you're having a blast playing, aside from The Sims, I mean, you know, stay in the genre.
They've got their own YouTube channel, K-Tel Classics.
Oh, wow.
All the commercials are there.
Oh, of course they are. Wow. See, there, folks, we've got on a rabbit hole.
Yes. All right. That's going to do it for us this week. But yes, if you do have your favorite game, leave us a comment or shoot us an email, h2o@sci-fi-for-me.com. And be sure you subscribe to our other shows. We do invite you to listen to everything that we do and watch all our TV shows and read all of our articles over at sci-fi-for-me.com. And we will be back with another episode next week. Timothy Harvey.
A pleasure.
And for all of us here at Sci-Fi for Me Radio, I'm Jason Hunt. Thank you very much for listening. Share us with your friends. Inflict this on your enemies. And join us again for another episode next week.
This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi For Me Radio.